And her son used to go on business trips. He was a tradesman. Anyway, whatever you call him, merchant or something. So he used to go off on business trips to India. This is in Tibet. He used to go on business trips to India. And she begged her son, she said, please, when you go to India, I said, this is the holy country of the Buddha, please bring me back a tooth of the Buddha. You know, bring me back a relic. And the son would always say to her, yes, 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 I'll do that. And he'd go off with cracking, wouldn't he? He'd go off and he'd go to India on his business trips and he'd come back and he always forgot. And the mother would just become distraught. She said, please, next time we go, remember. And he'd go off and he'd come back and he'd forget. And this happened over and over again. And finally, the son, he goes off to India on a business trip and he's on his way back, and just before he approaches the village, he remembers that he's forgotten again. And he thinks, oh no, my poor mother, she's gonna have a fit. So he's thinking, oh, what can I do? What can I do? And he's just looking down at the ground, and he notices there's the skull of a dead dog. And he thinks, well, I wonder if this will do the trick. And he pulls out a tooth. Do you have children like this? He pulls out a tooth. He wraps it all up beautifully. And he says, okay, let's give it a go. And he comes back, and his mother comes up to him. She says, oh, son, have you remembered? He says, yes, mother, I have brought you back the tooth of the Buddha. And she, oh, and she takes, and he hands her this beautiful thing, and she takes it, and she cherishes it, and she holds it to her heart, and she puts it on an altar, and she polishes it, and she prays, and she has so much prayer and offerings to this tooth. And miracles start happening. All these amazing things start happening. She starts curing people. She's like, all these incredible things just start happening. And she prays and prays, and there's more and more amazing things happening. And the son is like so embarrassed. He's like, oh my God, do you think I should tell her? And eventually there were just queues of people coming from all over the place to look at this relic of the Buddha. You see? And the son is just like under the ground, like, what am I going to do? And finally he thinks to himself, oh, I'm going to have to fess up about this. So he's like, you know, racking his conscience, and he thinks, oh, I'm just going to have to tell her. So he's heading off on the way. There's a long queue outside his mum's room, you know, to see this relic. And there she is, blessing everybody on the head with his dog's tooth. And they're all having these wonderful experiences, and he's like, heading on his way to tell his mum that it's not really. And just as he's on his way, suddenly he has this vision of the Buddha in front, and he falls to his feet and he's staring at the Buddha and says, I'm so sorry. He said, I'm so sorry, I did that to my mum. And the Buddha looks and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to go and tell her. I'm so sorry, I'm going to go and tell her. And the Buddha says, tell her what? And he says, well, tell her that it wasn't really a tooth of the Buddha. And the Buddha said, but who do you think the jaw of the dog belonged to then? And then he suddenly realized there's Buddhas everywhere. So these are stories, but actually they're quite important stories, because in Rinpoche's book, and I wanted to say this, Rinpoche gives three qualities for anyone who wants to do healing. Three qualities. Actually, he says there's a fourth, but the fourth one is quite rare. So he's mainly emphasizing, like, for us, three, and then if you can get the fourth, that's really good. But definitely two. Oh, earning your appetite, what could it possibly be? And the first quality that Rinpoche mentions is faith. What's this faith? Really, really important. Just an incredibly important quality. And I don't know what to say, really, because this is actually, for us as Westerners, sometimes this is our Achilles heel. The interesting thing is, faith works, you see. But intellectually, I don't know, it's like it's difficult for us. Faith seems to be quite difficult for us as Westerners. But it works. Even though I said at the very beginning, there are two ways that you get the realization that either you're incredibly simple, but you're having strong faith, or you're incredibly intelligent, and you can use that intelligence to break through, but still you need faith. But if you're in the middle, then it's difficult, quite difficult, it takes longer. So very, very strong faith, very strong faith. So when she says, you know, the person who's doing healing needs strong faith, and the person who's receiving the healing also, dependent on their faith, that's how much they can receive. That's actually the same on the spiritual path, really, depending on the faith. Now, we're not talking about faith here in terms of blind faith. Blind faith is not what we're talking about. In Buddhism, when we talk about faith, it talks about three kinds of faith. I do believe I've forgotten. Anyway, the first one is that kind of simple faith where you meet like with the teachings or with the Lama, and you just feel like, oh, I feel really inspired. Oh, that's so good. Like you have this kind of simple faith just wells up in you. That one is good, but it doesn't necessarily last. The second one is what they call aspiring faith, and that means you not only like a kind of a faith arise in your mind. Let's say you meet the Dalai Lama and you know it's just really an incredible experience, and you know, that's great. And then you go, but then you go away and you leave it. You see, you just leave it as what it was. But the second one is like you meet the Dalai Lama and you feel this incredible, that's an amazing person. And coupled with that is what they call aspiring. I think the first one's a clear faith, the second one's aspiring faith. So, but I don't want to get this wrong. So the aspiring faith is like you really want to be like that. It's not enough just to leave it as it is. You think, I want that. You know, that's what I want. You know, I want to be like that. So this kind of faith kind of sets you in motion and sets you in that direction to become like that. The first one does, but, you know, it's not as strong, it's not as forceful. It does put an imprint in the mind that eventually is going to ripen. But the second one is really quite directional. You know, you meet with a very inspiring teacher and you think, you know, I want to be like that. That's what I want. That's aspiring faith. But still, that's not enough. The third one is what we aim at, and that's called reasoned faith. And that means that having, you know, aspired to that, that you then set about studying and trying to understand the whole causes and everything like this. And then through analysis and reflection, you come to a place of clarity. You've actually thought about everything, you've thought it out, and it's clear in your mind, and that's called reasoned faith. So that's the one that we aim at, not blind faith. Otherwise the Buddha wouldn't have said, check out the teachings. But faith being very important, very, very crucial. The Buddha said faith is the mother of all, it gives birth to all qualities, it's like the mother on the path, it's like it gives birth to all the good qualities we have. So when we develop faith in something, then it's like, the example that I would want to give, you can disagree with me, but I would say that when you develop faith, it's almost like you start to open the windows and the doors, you know? It's like we walk around with the windows and the doors closed, generally. I mean, and it's like when there's faith, it's like you start to open up the windows and the doors to receive. And you just become open, you become receptive. And when there's that aspiring faith, it's like you actually become kind of yearning. You want. You really want. You're wanting to receive. You're not just opening the doors and windows, but you're wanting to receive. And then when you have this reasoned faith, it's like you have no doubt in your mind that this is how it is. You're total, nobody can shake your belief. You have total, absolute faith from the depths of your knowing that if I do this, this is going to be the result. In other words, in terms of Buddhism, if I do this practice, this is what's going to happen. You know, if I practice these causes, definitely compassion will be born in my mind. It's impossible for it not to happen. If I do this, this and this, has to result in that. There's just no, you know, you thought about it, you reflected on it, there's just no doubt in my mind, this is what's going to happen. So faith. The second one is morality, ethics. Ethics. You can't be a healer if you harm others. Obvious, right, isn't it? Ethics means what? You know, sometimes you use the word morality, but morality sounds so Victorian, doesn't it? Reminds you of the Royal Albert Hall. It's like, goodness me. And not only that, but it was sort of morality, you know, when it has that kind of connotation, it's like everybody pretending to be something and secretly doing something different, isn't it? That's what it conjures up, like the back streets of London and everybody putting on a nice face on the outside. So that's not... So then maybe we have to use this word ethics. And basically ethics is about restraining from harm. It's not harming others, which is a basic Buddhist concept. The Buddha said, in summarizing his teachings, the Buddha said, at least don't harm, and on the basis of that, if you can, try and help. She's not photocopying that now, is she? I hope she's not photocopying that now. In this chair? I don't want her to be doing that. I don't think she is, but just in case. So, ethics, restraint from harm. Now, restraint from harm, and then there are guidelines, you see. Now, what guidelines do we have in Buddhism? Well, there are five precepts, there are 10 non-virtues, that the basically, I mean, there are so many different ways of harming others, but we kind of condense it into 10, and we talk about the 10 non-virtues. I was just saying to somebody at lunchtime, when I first heard these 10 non-virtues, I was just crying. It was so beautiful. It's like what you always wanted, how you always wanted it to be in life. I was just saying over lunch that actually I always feel people who meet with Buddhism and never become Buddhist, they're not adopting anything new or taking on new ideas or beliefs or anything. They just found what they always believed. It was just, they just got confirmation that it's okay to believe these things, that it's all right, and it can be such a relief. I remember crying. I think many people cry when they hear the teachings. It's like, oh wow, you mean it's okay? You mean it's all right? Somehow, it didn't come across in the Ten Commandments. I don't know what, but certainly one of these 10 non-virtues: physical, verbal, and mental. So there are three doors. They say there are three avenues through which we harm others. And whenever we harm others, we're harming ourselves. So there are three, and it's the body and the speech and the mind. The most important is the mind, because it's, the mind is the chief, the mind is like the leader. So where the mind is and how the mind is, that affects what we say and that affects what we do. So physical, verbal, mental. They say if you can take care of your mind, then the physical and verbal are taken care of. It's just taken care of. If you can't take care of the mind, watch when you're in public, watch what you're doing. When you're talking, watch what you're saying. And, you know, in private, watch your mind. It's like, if you can't take care of your mind, watch what you do physically and verbally. Eventually, once the mind has become subdued, through reflecting on wisdom, through meditating on compassion, you won't say things that harm others. You won't do anything that harm others. It just won't happen. It always amazes me how quickly, when people come and get involved in Buddhism, they stop killing. And feel so happy about it. Like it's the most natural thing in the world. It happens so fast. People stop killing. It's like, not only people stop killing, but their mums and their dads and their kids stop killing. You know, one person in the family stops killing. Maybe they laugh for a little bit and then they follow suit. And it starts to become a thing where you just couldn't do it anymore. I mean, I'm not saying we don't tread on ants by mistake, you know, or we don't... occasionally, you know, turn the tap on and a fly goes down to... I'm not saying that. But I'm saying actually to walk up and intentionally kill something, it becomes unbearable. It's like you just wouldn't want it. It would be like, you know, my teacher often uses as an example of something you don't want, picking up somebody else's toilet paper. You don't want to pick up somebody else's toilet paper after they've used it, would you? It becomes like that. Like you wouldn't want to stamp on an ant and kill it and watch it die. It wouldn't be interesting. You don't want to pull the legs off of spiders. Like, God, you could think of much better things to do. And you wouldn't want to go fishing and pull the fish off the hook and watch the blood. And that happens to people who maybe used to do that regularly, go on fishing retreats. My friend, she went to the dentist before she came up here to do the Vipassana retreat, and the dentist said, "Where are you going?" She said, "Coromandel." And he said, "Oh, I go there for fishing retreats." And she just couldn't believe he was using that word retreat with fishing. She thought, "Well, there's someone's giving a message here." And she said, "They have these fishing rods. They have a batch, and they have these fishing rods in the batch." And she said, "What am I going to do with them?" I said, "Oh, I walked in." She invited me there, and I walked into the garage, and there were these fishing lines. And I said, "Do you use those?" And she said, "Actually, no." She said, "Actually, no. We used to, but," she said, "none of the family, even my husband and the kids, they don't kill anymore." She's Buddhist, they're not, but they just don't do it anymore. You know, first they laugh, but now they don't do it anymore. And then she said, "You know, what am I going to do with these things?" I said, "Well, if you sell them, someone else will use them." So they decided they would, I don't know, bury them, throw them, I can't remember what. But it was quite interesting. It does fascinate me how quickly that comes, that awareness comes. My mum, when I was younger, she used to take a boiling kettle and pour it over ants. You know that one? So we were kind of brought up to do that. You wouldn't get rid of ants. You boil up a kettle and you pour hot water on them and they die. It's really horrible, yeah? And then when I stopped killing, she not only stopped doing that, well, she did it a little bit and then she felt so guilty she stopped, but she also started pulling Daddy, you know, Daddy Long Legs out the bath instead of flushing them down the plug. And she also started to stop other people from doing that. Well, she became quite rigorous in telling people they mustn't kill this and they mustn't kill that. She was quite a crusader, my mother. And it's quite sweet of it, isn't it? I mean, it's really quite beautiful. I mean, it may seem like a small thing, but I don't think it is, because I think it's the beginning of the recognition that there are so many beings we share this planet with, and they all don't want to suffer. They all have a life. They're all very precious. And we have this human life. That makes us custodians, really, doesn't it? That means we should be taking care. We should take care. We should take care. We shouldn't be using. We should take care. Yeah. Alex Berzin, a translator, translated for many, many years, translated for His Holiness, he used to give the example, and he's Jewish, he used to give the example in terms of killing. He used to say, "Well, okay, look, the mosquito lands on your arm, okay? Then what do? You go like that." He said, "No, you don't think much of that, but just look at the mind. What was your mind saying? Your mind was saying, I don't like what that creature's doing, so I'm just going to take its life away. And so you do." And he said, "You look at that mind that says, I don't like what that creature's doing, I'm going to take its life away." He said, "Magnify that, and you've basically got the Holocaust." He's Jewish, right? That's what he said. I thought that's so nice. And look at the mind that says, "Okay, well, I don't, you know, well, let's just move it along." Or whatever. So, you see, ethics, there's an increased sensitivity and awareness and a gentleness and an openness starts to awaken within the mind. And ethics is actually the foundation for ethics and devotion is the foundation for generating realizations of the past. But ethics is the foundation for developing concentration. So if you really, really want to do meditation, you really want to meditate, you must have a solid foundation in ethics, because if you don't have a solid foundation in ethics, you won't be able to develop concentration. Why? Because your hatred, desire, energies are out of control, and you're not controlling them physically, you're not controlling them verbally, so how on earth are you going to be able to control those minds when you sit down to meditate? You can't do it. It's not going to happen. You have no contentment in your mind. Also, not killing, which means not intentionally taking the life of anything at all. Not stealing, which means not intentionally taking anything that hasn't been freely given to you. No sexual misconduct, which is given all kinds of different connotations. Mummy, as she used to say, just don't harm others, dear, you know. Don't harm others. Don't use others for your pleasure. So responsibility. Then those are the physical ones. Then the verbal ones not lying, so they're not intentionally deceiving anybody. That can be from what you say or what you write or how you indicate. So sometimes you might indicate just with a bodily gesture something, so not doing that. Not intentionally deceiving others, and then there's divisive speech. That's when you try and split people. And people are friends, and then you go and you talk about this one and behind the back, and then you go and talk about that one, and you split people. You create this harmony. So not intentionally doing that. Then harsh speech. So not intentionally saying harsh things to people that hurt. So sometimes you can say such cruel things to somebody else that it hurts more than if you took something from them or you beat them. You can really in a short time create so much disturbance in somebody else's mind. So harsh speech, and then idle gossip, which is like meaningless chatter. So not using this speech, which is so precious, with which we can accomplish so much, do so much meaningful, not using it, just wasting it in terms of gossip. Gossip, I think, sometimes we say idle chatter, gossip, but I think, you know, it reminds me of these, you know when you go to the supermarket checkout, and they have, you know, my husband's an alien. You don't get so much here in America. You have like the front of the headline is my husband, I was married to an alien, or you know, the captain of the Titanic is found alive and his pipe is still smoking. You see this? National Enquirer, I think they call it. I'm not making this up, they really do say things like this. But it's also obviously all these endless magazines, like, you know, this one has split up with that one, and this one is dating that one, and all kinds of things. And you think it's harmless, but then if somebody were printing that and spreading it all about you, and you're having a hard time, you wouldn't be that happy. I mean, remember President Clinton got all this stuff printed all around the world about he did this and he did that. I mean, does it hurt? Yeah, I'm sure it really hurts. So you're trying to ban what hurts others. So sometimes you might think it's quite innocent, but then if somebody was gossiping about you saying this and that, and it's not necessarily true, it would hurt. So we try not to do that. Then the three of mana, which is the most serious, are covetousness. That's wanting something somebody else has and kind of and planning to get it. You know, like I want that. I'm going to get that for myself. It's a very unhappy mind, that one. And then ill will, malice. Kind of having intentionally wanting to harm others. And the third one is, the worst one is wrong views, where you just don't, wrong views. So these negative, can we stop it cracking? Oh, okay. Oh, that's what happened. Oh. Typical me. Don't know, little black cap anywhere? Calling little black cap? Come in, little black cap, the time is up.
It might have fallen down.
Excuse me, everybody. Oh, it's that easy. There you are. So wrong views, that's denying existence of cause and effect, and those three jewels of refuge and so forth. So these 10 non-virtues, they're arranged in order of severity, the worst ones being the mental ones. So you see, what happens when we engage in these non-virtues is that we put, first of all, it harms others, and then secondly, every time we do any action at all, any intentional action of body, speech and mind that we engage in puts an imprint on our minds that will ripen later as an effect in terms of our happiness or suffering when the causes come together. I want to say that one more time because this is the definition of karma. So you hear a lot about karma. In California, you hear a lot about karma. You know, people talk about karma, but they don't really know what it means. So what karma is actually is intentional action. It actually is the fact of intention, karma. So any intentional action, we'll go step by step, intentional action. Why? Because, okay, we walk over the grass, we don't intend, maybe we stand on a creature, but we didn't intend to do that. So there is an action that's been created, but we didn't intend it. You see the difference? Karma is not black and white, it's a lot of grey areas. It's explained that it's not that difficult to understand emptiness, the ultimate nature of reality, but only a Buddha can fully understand the subtle workings of karma, the law of cause and effect, which is conventional reality. So, any intentional action, and now what is an action? An action is something created by body, speech or mind. Now, we don't normally think as something we say being an action or something we think being an action, but it is, and in fact it can be the heaviest. So you can just be sitting there looking all sweet and innocent and having thoughts about how you can harm someone and what am I going to say when I see them next? You create negative karma, the heaviest negative karma. Has to be like that really, doesn't it, when you think about it? Wouldn't it have to be like that? Why would it only be what you do? It's how you take care of your mind. And so similarly with the 10 virtuous actions, the opposite. You can be sitting there and look like you're doing nothing, but in your mind you're generating loving kindness for every single living being, and you're just visualizing that you are just becoming wish fulfilling. Whatever you can do, you're just sending out light and love to every single being without exception, and you're thinking about how to heal relationships, and you're developing compassion, and you're creating so much incredible good karma. You're putting so much positive energy on your mind stream. Like that river, you know, we're either throwing dark blue dye in it or white dye in it, black dye in it or white dye in it. So don't think it's just the negative things, it's the same for positive. So intentional actions of body, speech and mind, and the heaviest karmas are created mentally. Every intentional action of body, speech and mind places on the mind stream an imprint. Now, when you do something, there is an immediate effect. Generally speaking, there's an immediate effect of doing something. But there's not just an immediate effect, there's also a long-term effect. Why is there a long-term effect? Because when you do something, it's like an imprint or an impression being put on the mind. And these seeds, these imprints in their minds ripen later, and we don't quite know why things are happening to us the way they are. We kind of tend to think, oh, it's just happening. But from the Buddhist point of view, nothing just happens. It's not like that. It's because we have the imprint or the seed on our consciousness from past actions. So if I would, let's say we're doing this course, Ultimate Healing, right? And then I say, anyone got any questions? Yeah, she sticks up her hand and she says, well, I just think that everything you're saying is a lot of nonsense. And I say, how dare you say that? And I throw the book at her. Now, there will be an immediate effect if I do that. There will be an immediate effect. I mean, people will be shouting, screaming, running out the hall, demanding their money back, complaining, sending emails, lumpsuppers, saying, you know, what is that and I'm doing? There'll definitely be an immediate effect. But there won't just be an immediate effect, there'll be a long-term effect also. From having done that action, there'll be a long-term effect. You have to think about this. I mean, these are things we have to reflect on. Actions we've done in the past, they set up patterns to do things again and again and again in the future. And why do we do them? We do them because we've done them before. They've become habitual. That's why we do things. You know, Venerable Rabina, I was talking to her one time, it's interesting. I have a conversation about it. She goes and counsels prisoners. And she said to me, you know, all these prisoners, even in death row, what happened is, you see, probably they got a bit drunk or a bit stoned. And then they did something. Scary, actually, because it could happen to any one of us. And a lot of them, they actually don't remember doing it. Now, I totally understand that, don't you? Haven't you done things in your life? You've just done them. And afterwards it's like, oh, what did I do that for? Well, you did it because you did it in the past. And you had the imprint in your consciousness to do it, therefore it happened again. So we're just like a walking bunch of bad habits, you know, habits. Like I said before, we're like a walking bunch of habits. And this is what we're working with. So they've done it before, so they do it. And then the rest of life is suffering, you see. The rest of life is suffering. This is why we have to be so careful. We have to be really... In some ways, you have to be kind of scared of your mind. One time I said to my teacher, I said, you know, I'm really scared of my mind. He said, that's good. He said, you have to be scared of your mind. He said, it's like the American government, you know, they're scared of Bin Laden terrorists. Because of that, they take a lot of precautions. He said, you should feel the same way. You know, really, really protect your mind. Because things can be going really, really well, and you just don't take care, and poof, something happens. And then you're going a whole new way. Because this is what happens to karma, you see. Something ripens, and then as it ripens, it brings a whole new stream of things happening. So here we are, going on fine, and teaching the course, and suddenly, because yes, you put a hand up and I threw the book, oh boy, am I ever in trouble. You see? And another whole thing is going to ripen, and can you imagine all the consequences? Forget about penguins eating crisps, you know. Oh, it's amazing. But isn't it like that in our lives? You just go to the wrong place, or you just don't take care, and a whole set of circumstances ripens, and you're caught in it. Why? This is karma. You're just driven along. It's like Ramasan Kadir gives the example of like being in a fast flowing stream, and you're just kind of like, poof, you can't do any about it. That's how it is for those guys in the prisons. They were caught in the stream of their past actions. They've done it before, so they've done it again. And if nothing happens, if you don't purify, if you don't stop, if you don't cut that, you'll do it again and again and again and again. I once asked this guy in Singapore, I met this guy in Singapore, he was a doctor, I think. Anyway, he had certificates all over his walls, and one of the things he did was NLP, but he also did past life hypnosis. And he told me he remembered he had gone back over 60,000 past lives. I can't imagine how you do that, to be honest, but anyway, never mind. And so I said to him, he wasn't Buddhist or anything, I said to him, well, what's it like? Is it interesting? He said, oh, it's such a drag. He said, you know, it's like one life you do this, and then the next life you do it again, and the next life you do it again. He said, it's so boring. He said, you just see how you did the same thing over and over and over and over again. And he said, the people that you hate in this life, you've been that in the past. He said, you know, that was... Anyway, so like this is karma. We put all these imprints, and they ripen. They have immediate effects, but then they have long-term effects. There will be a long-term effect in the future. You know, maybe in the future, in another life, I'm teaching a course, and I say any questions, and somebody else will put up their hand, and the same thing will happen again. If I don't regret it, if I don't purify it, if I don't produce any antidotes. Of course, that's a kind of stupid example, because it's not, I mean, first, it's not going to happen, and secondly, of course, I would regret it. But there are many examples in our lives which are totally commonplace, where we don't regret. And when we don't regret actions, we can't purify them. It's like you go fishing, you catch a big fish and you rejoice in it for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks and you show everyone the picture. I mean, are you regretting it? Are you purifying the action of killing? No. You're just making it stronger, stronger, stronger. Often happens when you teach the 10 non-virtuous actions, actually, and then people come up after the course and they say, well, I know you were teaching that, you know, and I really like Buddhism, but I'm afraid, you know, I'm having an affair with a married man, and I don't plan to change that. And I usually say to them, well, the Buddha explains how it is, and he says, if you do this kind of action, you're going to suffer. And then it's up to you, you know, is it suffering? And they say, oh, it's really suffering. I'm suffering a lot, but I don't want to change it. I said, well, there you go. The Buddha tells the truth. It's like, what am I going to do? It's like the angry young man, right? You can see the truth, but the strength of that calm that's ripening is so strong, you see, you can't change, you can't break out. One time I was teaching a course, I often tell this story, it's quite cute. I was teaching a course at the Dushita, and I was talking about 10 non-virtuous action. I was talking about going through these 10 non-virtuous. And at the end, this guy, Israeli guy, he... he said, you know, can I talk to you? Can I discuss something? I said, sure. And we went and we were talking, and he said, you know, the other people are having a bit of difficulty, but he said, as far as I'm concerned, everything that you said in this course, all these Buddhist teachings, they're absolutely right on. Totally. He said, I believe them completely. He said, but there's one thing I don't accept. And I said, okay, what's that? And he said, I can't see anything wrong with killing. He said, I kill for my, he said, that's my livelihood, I kill people. He said, you know, either I kill them or I send other people out to kill them. He said, I can't see anything wrong with that. Can you imagine? It's not the usual kind of objection. I was a bit stunned. Anyway, I said to him, well, one of my teachers, you know, Dan Dawson, Kyabji Rinpoche, on the show, is a very eminent lama. I think you'd better go and talk to him. I didn't think he was going to get it from me. But he had a point. He explained his point. You know, he was dealing with terrorists. He was in the army. And he said, you know, these people, these you don't call them terrorists, do you? What do you call them? Anyway, they're plotting, they find out they're plotting to bomb a bus or something and kill people, so they go in there and wipe them out before. He said, what's wrong with that? So anyway, I don't think anyone in this room is going to agree with that one. Where they get to? So this is karma then. So when you do these actions, they put an imprint in the mind, and that imprint is going to ripen later in terms of your experience when the conditions come together. Now the conditions are always some kind of conditions are coming together, so always some kind of karmas are ripening. So we are basically always experiencing the results of actions that we've done in the past. Always, whatever we experience is basically the result of previous actions. That doesn't mean Buddhism is fatalistic, because we always have the freedom to choose what we're going to do. If we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But we also do find that we get trapped in patterns, don't we? And that's because we've habituated ourselves to them. It's very interesting. You find this, just like those women who are having the affair, and they said, well, it's really suffering, but I'm not going to change. It's like they're trapped in that pattern. They can't break out, even though they can see. So it's karma. Now, you can say, well, how do I know this whole karma thing? We have to think about this whole karma thing. Well, how do I know karma is this? Now, I don't know if that was the right way to put it. Anyway, I just basically want to say to you, you have three alternatives. Because if you want to reflect on this, because some people are quite new, so I'll introduce this topic. You have three alternatives as to why things happen. The first reason why things happen could be that there's no reason at all. Things just happen. They just happen for no reason. That's one way of believing, and many people believe that, right? It just happens. You just happen to be here at Mahamudra. No reason at all, it just happened, right? That's okay, so that's one way. The second reason why things happen could be because God wills it to be that way, you know? It's part of the divine plan, and therefore this is why things happen, because this is God's will. And, you know, that's another way of believing, and of course there are millions and millions of people in the world who believe that. So then you have two alternatives. And the third alternative, you can see if you can dream up any more later, but basically it all fits into these three. The third reason why things happen is because you have created the causes for them to happen, and the conditions have come together, and so you experience the effect. This is why things happen, and this is a Buddhist way of believing, that whatever we experience is a result of a previous cause that we ourselves have created. And you can give trillions of other reasons. You can say, oh no, it's because of our atoms, our genes, it's because of the way I was brought up, it's because of my parents, it's because of, what else is there?
No ozone layer.
Huh?
No ozone layer.
No, because there's no ozone there. It's because, no, people don't say that. No, they say it's because, no, what do people say? You know, it's biology, it's neurology, it's the neurons firing in my brain a certain way, it's the genes I inherited from my mother and father, it's the way I was nurtured, it was the way it was the society I was brought up into, it was the education I had, it was blah, blah, blah. I can say all these different things. But Buddhism is still going to come back and say to you, yes, but why? Why do you have those kind of genes? Why were you born to those particular parents? Why? Well, did you have that kind of education? Because, you know, you have created the cause for it. And we see this in ordinary life. It's explained in karma. Of course, the subtleties of karma are very difficult to understand, but there are four general principles to karma. And the first general principle to karma is the fact that if you create a cause, you must experience the result. Once a cause has been created, there will be a result. So if you do something, anything, it has an effect. There will be an effect. And the way in which this is understood is that whenever you do a negative action, it will always result in suffering. Whenever you do a positive action, it will always result in happiness. And there's no... It cannot be otherwise. It's like planting... an apple tree, an apple seed, you must get an apple tree from it. So whenever you do a negative action, you always get the result of suffering. Whenever you do a positive, you always get the result. The second thing, so this is important, you see, because what it means, the second thing is that karma increases. So from even a very small seed can come a huge result. In the physical world, from a small seed can come a huge tree. But they say, in terms of karma, intentional action, even a small intentional action can create a huge result. This is what I always think of, like, they give the example of a small spark that lands on a haystack and it can burn down a forest. But I always think of the example of the First World War. You know the First World War? The Archduke Ferdinand. Did I get that right? Is it Bosnia-Herzegovina? Bosnia-Herzegovina? Anyway, that's my history lesson. So this guy, basically, who's the King of Austria, I think, or the Duke of Austria, Archduke. Anyway, this guy is in this carriage, and a young student shot him. Because this little bit of metal went into that heart, and it stopped functioning, millions of people died. Millions. Millions. That was the First World War. 9/11. You know Tenzin Palmer? Everyone heard of Tenzin Palmer now? She's become quite famous now. She's an English nun. And I heard she was giving talks in America. And I heard it was a packed room. And somebody put up their hands and they said, "What do you think about 9/11? And she said to them, "You Americans, you get so obsessed. It's just two buildings. What are you so upset about? People are dying all the time. There's millions of people dying all the time. And you just get fixated on these two buildings." Got more courage than me. They actually accepted it. But then, of course, she's talking to people who can accept it. Because when you look at the aftermath of the fact that they did get fixated on it, millions of people have suffered. Just played right into Bin Laden's hands. Bush couldn't have played more into Bin Laden's hands. You know, Bin Laden couldn't have wished for a better result than what happened. Attacking Iraq and scenes of little Muslim kids being blown up, blasted all over the Arab world. He couldn't have wanted any more than that, could he? Really, it's really so. So, you know, so karma is explaining that from a small thing. So it's quite interesting, you know. So then how did you get to Mahamudra? Check back. Could have been just a small thing. From a small thing. But there is a cause. There's a reason why we're sitting here. There's a reason for everything. This is the Buddhist understanding anyway. The third aspect of karma is that if you don't create the cause, you can't experience result. And this is like, if you want to make a cup of tea, you have to boil up the water and have a tea bag, at least. You can also add milk and sugar, or honey, or maple syrup. But or artificial sweetener. But at least you have to have hot water in a tea bag. And similarly, in ordinary life, we find that, I was trying to think of an example. The classic examples are, it happens, doesn't it? Like, there's an airplane full of people, and the airplane bursts into fire on the landing, and, like, you know, 99 people are killed, and one person gets a broken leg, and somebody else just walks off and says, "What happened?" It happens, like, things like that happen. Things like that happen. And the reason they give, they say, well, because those 99 all had they created the cause to be killed in that, but, you know, the one had the cause to have a broken leg, and the other one didn't have the cause, they didn't experience the result. So you don't create the cause, you don't get the result. It also, when you have this understanding of karma, it also helps to see why things happen in the world. Like, why are there all these famines?